So that was really the consumer insight. And then we were in business school constantly talking about disruptive innovation and realized that there was an opportunity in the beauty space and the media space to reimagine beauty e-commerce, to really make it possible for somebody to make a first purchase of a product online. So that is why we have a really big importance on an offline product, but just as much importance as our online product.
Certainly one of the most innovative companies to come out of Harvard Business School in recent years. And my plug for the company is it's an amazing birthday, Christmas, or Hanukkah gift. You give it to anybody and it's an instant winner. I've probably given about 10 out myself.
Yep.
So go home and buy one immediately. Next up, Eric Koger, founder of ModCloth, has possibly one of the most romantic startup stories here at South by Southwest. He founded his company with his high school sweetheart, and that was already over a decade ago. So when we think about the lifespan of both companies and relationships, Eric is really at the far end of the spectrum here. So Eric, can you tell us about ModCloth?
Sure. So ModCloth is a community-oriented e-retailer of independent designer fashion and decor. We bring sort of like a never-ending stream of curated, cool fashion and decor products for a very specific community of customers. It tends to have a very vintage-inspired or retro feel to it. The business is really built on kind of two elements of innovation, a very lean, responsive supply chain, and a very social, engaging experience in which the customers actually get to participate in what products the indie designers are bringing to market for them.
Is anybody here a user of ModCloth? Has anybody purchased? Yeah, so good number of fans right here in this audience. Dave Gilboa, one of the founders of Warby Parker. You know, one of my thoughts when I was thinking about Warby Parker is we're talking about glasses here. South by Southwest, this might be one of the places with the highest concentrations of people who purchase your glasses in the entire world, just looking out in the audience. I think it's awesome. Unfortunately, I got LASIK surgery, so I'm not wearing a pair myself. Otherwise, I would be right up there. So can you tell us a little about the founding story and how you guys are operating now?
Sure. So Warby Parker is a vertically integrated eyewear brand, so we sell our own brand of glasses online for $95, including prescription lenses, which is a fraction of the price of what you'd pay for a pair of glasses in a retail store. And for every pair of glasses we sell, we distribute a pair to someone in need. And started the company, like Katya, in business school. I was traveling before school and I lost my glasses. They cost me $700 and I showed up the first day of school without owning a pair of glasses. I couldn't justify paying that much for a new pair. And started talking with some of my buddies at school about why glasses were so expensive. And the four of us who ended up founding the company, we all had that frustrating experience where we lost a pair of glasses, broke a pair of glasses, and couldn't understand why they cost several hundred dollars. It didn't make any sense to us that this is technology that had been around for 800 years. Why did a new pair of glasses cost more than an iPhone? It just that fundamentally didn't make any sense to us. And so being business school students, we started looking into the fundamentals of industry and realized that the only reason why glasses are so expensive is that there's essentially an oligopoly that controls the entire eyewear market. And on average, glasses in the U.S. are marked up between 10 and 20 times what they cost to manufacture. And so we decided to bootstrap the business and launch out of our apartments while we were in school and create our own brand of glasses and sell them directly to consumers online. And something that was really important to us as a founding team was also just creating a for-profit company that had a positive impact. And so that starts by with our customers, by providing great value and great service to our customers. But we also decided to partner with Vision Spring, which is the nonprofit that my co-founder Neil used to run before business school. And so we work with them, and they actually train men and women all over the world to become entrepreneurs themselves and sell glasses into communities that otherwise don't have access to glasses. So for every pair of glasses we sell, we work with Vision Spring to distribute a pair to someone in need.
Okay, so a truly inspiring story with a double bottom line. Who did you sell your first pair of glasses to?
So before we even had a website up, none of us are technical on the founding team, and so it took us twice as long and cost us twice as much to get a website up. We had to fire our first agency that was building our site. And so we had we received our inventory before we had a website up, and so we had a bunch of trunk shows just for our friends at school. And so we got we're just doing kind of a lot of offline sales before we even had a website.
Okay, friend to friends and, yeah, and family. Okay, great. Thank you very much, guys. So, you know, even though a lot of people came in to talk about this subject, how to ensure your startup is defensible, one of the things that occurred to me is that this is basically about competition and how to ward off competition. That problem has been around as long as business has been around. So my first question is, you know, to Katya, who really helped organize this panel, what is different now that's so important that we are organizing a panel about this subject, defending your startup?
I mean, I think it's clear that this is always a problem that has existed, as you pointed out, since business. But I think the biggest difference today is the speed with which you can start a company, and that is a testament to why South by Southwest is so big today. It's much easier to start anything. The cost of starting is different, and the ability to kind of understand what people are doing is, it's just so readily available. We're all so connected. For us, you know, what really happened was that we had a community that started organically on YouTube, with women who were getting these boxes and opening them and just exclaiming about this experience. And all of a sudden, a feed started as, come to Canada, come to Vietnam, come to Mexico, come to Germany. And, you know, that's just out there for anybody to see. That's a great test market. You can identify right then and there that there is demand for the product. So it's just where we are today, Web 2.0, we're in everybody's face all the time.
So it's just a lot faster to start companies.
It's a lot faster and cheaper. You don't need, you know, $100 million and your own proprietary servers to have an online business.
So the time that you have as an innovator, your head start, has shrunk compared to 1,000 years ago.
I also think it's more important to be a global business now than it was before, to just dominate one market. That it's an expectation that you need to dominate every market or be in major markets as a leading brand in your space. So that sets the, you know, the bar higher, and or makes it more of an imperative to get to the other countries first.
Wait, why is that an expectation? Whose expectation?
Financial markets expectation, investors expectation, customers expectation. With information flowing more readily, that there's more of a economies of scale in marketing to have a global brand.
Yeah, that's interesting. Even tied back to Katya's point, which is, you know, you put up a YouTube video and all of the comments on the YouTube video are, why isn't this in Japan yet? Mm-hmm. Immediately. So the pressure comes from all angles. Mm-hmm. Somebody else want to comment on what today's environment, why today's environment makes this such an important question?
I mean, there are also just groups like the Samwer Brothers, Rocket, and a bunch of other groups like that, that their entire business is just finding things that work, usually in the U.S., and then cloning them in other countries. And so they're just constantly looking for kind of that next innovative idea and figuring out. And they have capital, they have management, and they're really not creating anything original themselves. They're really just looking to replicate a model that's already worked somewhere else. And I think that didn't exist even 5 or 10 years ago. And so I think businesses just have to be aware that this is going to happen and have a point of view on, you know, whether they want to be a global business immediately or cede some of that market opportunity to these groups that are going to go after markets that they're not addressing.
Okay, so one of the things that we'll definitely have to touch on later is, at what point do you have to start making these decisions? Am I a global company? Am I going to expand into other verticals? Or am I going to stay with my core for as long as possible? By the way, just to check in, because it's a little hard to tell our own voices, how is the sound? Can people in the back hear? Yeah? We're good on that? Okay, excellent. Okay, so we're going to start off by discussing the nature of the problem. So, you know, which types of companies are more at risk than others of being attacked by strong competition early on? Are there certain verticals or certain demographic areas? Who's at risk here? Katya, you?
I think anything that is really consumer-facing is obviously a little bit more at risk, and anything that's kind of facing the press and getting a lot of press is who's at risk. So when there's buzz, I think there's risk.
And there's buzz.
And that tends to kind of fall on, you know, the companies here. It's kind of sexy industries. That's this consumer facing. People are talking. Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. I mean, we've got trendy eyeglasses. We have mod clothing. We have beauty products. Hotels, are hotels sexy?
Hotels are so sexy.
Very sexy. Couldn't be sexier.
So, I think it's also primarily when it's a business model innovation more than a technology innovation. So if you look at why Groupon had so many clones as opposed to Dropbox, is that to replicate what Dropbox built, you need just really hardcore engineering. Whereas something like Groupon, you can put up a site and just start reaching out to a bunch of local businesses. And so if you look at some of the businesses on this panel, it's primarily been kind of just business new ways of addressing kind of a business need. So it's more business model innovation. And so I think that's probably why we're up here, because we have seen some clones and other people that have seen what we're doing and have tried to replicate it.
So business models easier to replicate than something that's clearly a new technological invention. Do the others agree, or does that, yeah, Eric?
Yeah, I would just say it translates into difficulty, right? So the ease with which you can be replicated, you will be replicated.
Is that, that doesn't diminish the work that you guys have done, saying that your companies are easier to replicate than...
Well, just because there are copycats doesn't mean the copycats are successful. So it's, they can pop up and they may take a piece of your market share, but most of them actually suck because they lack... inspiration and aren't able to actually do something that is meaningful to the customer.
So it's easy to look at your company and say, I want to copy this, and do a bad job copying. You think that that's...
I'd say it's difficult to copy a great product, just generally speaking. And so when you have like proprietary technology, that makes it even more difficult. But you can solve the same problem with a different technology, so you can come at the same problem in different ways. But I'd say generally speaking, difficulty is highly correlated with the degree to which you're going to have copycats.
Okay.
I guess like just the point of that is you can only copy what you can see, right? So everything behind the scenes, you can't copy. Thank God.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that the companies that get copied more often are the ones where there's a perception that it's easy to copy, right? So that's why we saw so many copies of Groupon, so many Groupon clones, and we saw all of them really go away, because they realized that even though they could launch for the first couple of weeks, first couple of months of deals, it was very hard to sustain that and to grow that level of deal flow. And so I think that that might be one of the reasons you see clones of companies like ours, is that on the outside they look like it's easy. I can build an app, or I can build a brand, or I can build nice clothing. But at scale, it gets more and more difficult. So we can sort of transition to that maybe.
So part of it is just being aware, not being scared by the hordes, recognizing that some of these are just paper tigers that aren't going to last.
Yeah, if Andrew Mason had been scared, he wouldn't be running a $10 billion company today. So.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot, guys. So now, we'd like to just hear a little bit about your individual competition that you guys are facing. And so I want to ask the question in this form. Is there a day when you woke up and you said, hey, we really wanted to go there, we wanted to expand into that country, or we wanted to expand into that vertical, and you woke up and you said, oh shit, somebody else is already there. This is not good. So what is the horror story when you realized, here's somebody who's invading your territory? So anybody want to, Dave, you want to take a stab?
Yeah, so for us it's been less about that, someone is cutting off an opportunity of where we think we might want to go eventually. And for us it's been more just direct copycats. And so about 8 months after we launched, our first copycat emerged, and it was just a couple kids out of Brooklyn that basically replicated everything exactly about our business. They tried to copy our website and used direct images and text from our website. They even copied our copyright disclaimer word for word that said, And, you know, so that was just, we had just a very visceral, emotional reaction, because this is something that we'd been working on for 2 years, and all of a sudden, you know, these kids were, you know, felt like they were just stealing from all the hard work that we'd put into this business. And since then, there have been a bunch of other copycats that have emerged, a couple just mom and pops, and then up to Blue Fly, which is a public company. They launched a clone called iFly, and so it's been primarily just copycats in the U.S. We have seen a few copycats emerge internationally, and expect more to come. But it's been more just kind of a frustrating experience. None of them have really gained any traction, I think, for the reasons that Katya and Eric were mentioning, that we've really focused on building a brand. And on the surface, while it might look easy to sell glasses online, there are a lot of complexities in terms of creating a great customer experience. And it's really difficult to actually build a brand, and that's all we've been focused on, and have really just tried to occupy kind of as many hilltops as we can through press and just being top of mind amongst influencers. And none of these copycats have really gained any traction at all as a result, just because I think it's less interesting to write about people that are copying something. People want to be associated with innovators, and we're continually just focused on how we can provide innovative solutions for our customers and the best possible service and products for our customers, while all these copycats are focused on how they can catch up to us.
Okay, so that's good. You sense some frustration, but at the same time, some confidence that you're still doing it better than everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's more annoying than anything else. And so, for example, there was one of these copycats. We sent them a cease and desist letter because they literally were using a bunch of images and text from our site. And so we could have sued them, but that was just going to be a distraction. So we sent them a cease and desist letter. And then they published in a blog post the cease and desist letter accusing us of bullying them. And then, that got posted on a couple other blogs and made us look like the bad guys, that we were trying to stifle competition. We're not going to respond publicly to that because we don't want to give them any more attention, but it's just kind of frustrating that we have to deal with that more than anything else.
Yeah. Eric, how about you? What day did you wake up?
Well, I would say it's similar. We've not had like an oh shit moment, but mostly like those assholes moments where our credit is being stolen in some way.
Big difference.
And I mean, like literally there's a startup that, so Susan and I started the business in high school, husband and wife team, we have a dog, like there's this really cute founding story, and we tell that story on our site. And there's a copycat that like copied similar format, same picture with the dog, like started a couple together. It's like, really? And it's a couple that's done this for a couple other fashion-oriented retail sites. So that was just like, really frustrating. We've done the cease and desist thing and not had that blown up, but it's always tempting to get into a fight with these people online, and it's always, almost always the right thing to not engage, because it just gives them publicity and credibility. Or publicity, not really credibility. But I'd say it's, try to continue to stay looking forward, because they're looking at your back.
Yeah. So Katya, how about you?
I guess the first time was about 7 months after we launched. And I think that was the most surprising thing, was just like how fast this was, because we were aware of the existence of companies that are purely created. They have funds associated with them, and they exist to just copy business models that are, flourishing in the U.S. mostly, but they had never done so as quickly. So I think that was like our first surprise, how quick it happened. And then it was the same thing. It was just like reading, the exact way that we describe our business on somebody else's site. And we had a similar thing, like in German, ich bin Katja, ich bin Haley.
What?
Yeah.
And they literally named themselves Katja and Haley.
Yeah.
Is that...
So...
Isn't that just stupid? I mean, it doesn't... That they could change, do the most minor things.
Yeah.
Okay. So Sam, how about you?
It wasn't so much a moment for me in that I knew that this was going to be coming. And I knew that we would have competition. You know, hotel is a very profitable category. It's a very competitive category. We were going up against some guys with a lot of big resources. And it was actually the surprise for me was that, and the reason we started, one of the reasons we started Hotel Tonight is that we were looking around at the market. I checked the App Store every day saying, this is such a no-brainer for Expedia or for Priceline or for Travelocity to launch. And I kept on checking the App Store every day, knowing that it would be there. And then after a couple months of that, I said, well, shit, I'm just going to build this, you know, and we're just going to do it. And so really the surprise for me was that we didn't see competition or not even competition or just, you know, the focus of what we do and the recipe of what we do out in the market beforehand. In terms of the moments we had, I think 4 months in, this was before we even thought we had or knew that we had a business or not. We saw a European competitor, a Euro clone, and that was really flattering and kind of cool and sort of like a David Hasselhoff moment. And then last fall, so we have about 10 of those now around the world. And then on the other end of the spectrum, Priceline has taken a lot of what we do and put it into a product called Tonight Only. And that's on the other end of the spectrum, of course, in terms of resources. We feel we can talk about, you know, how we view that and how we, you know, feel very confident in our market.
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that once we start getting to the solutions, okay. You know, how to deal with this problem.
So, yeah, we got Shatner coming at us, so.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, it looks like the set of competitors range from annoying little clones who copy every detail and have no real substance behind them to very serious incumbent players who say, we like what you're doing, we're going to try to do the same thing. And these are very serious competitors that you need to think strategically about. So we have this range of competition. Just very briefly, I want to touch on the topic of ethics, because we've already brought up a couple of times sort of the prototypical bad guys out there, the cloning factory that is known as Rocket Internet. Already, you know, at least two of the panelists have brought these guys up. So, you know, the basic story behind these guys are they're three German brothers who back in, you know, around 2000 cloned eBay in Germany, sold it back to eBay for something like $60 million and said, wow, you know, that's a really good model. Let's do this again. And since then, they've done the same thing with Zappos, and they've done the same thing with Airbnb, and about, you know, 100 other companies. Now, you know, you can take either side of the story, saying, you know, this is a really unethical thing, or you can say, well, this is a product that we really needed delivered to all of these emerging markets, and it might have taken a long time to get there without them. So, you know, I just sort of want to get a poll, you know, of the audience. How many people think that the concept of taking a great business model that works and saying, I'm going to do the same thing, you know, maybe in another country? How many, like, if we would say, you know, on one of the end of the spectrum, you know, this is a, you know, completely acceptable, normal way of doing business. This is competition. The other end of the spectrum, you know, is that this is something that evokes just a truly visceral reaction of disgust. How many people think, you know, that's fine, just the nature of competition? How many people are really bothered by that concept? Okay. For some reason, the ethical, the moral people are all clustered in that corner. So do you guys feel the same way? Is this just, you know, part of doing business?
I think it depends on the degree that they're replicating kind of what already exists. So if it's an exact replica down to, you know, naming the company after, you know, naming the founders, Katya and Haley, and having all, you know, all the designs the same, then... Yeah, I do think that crosses an ethical boundary, and when we've seen copycats that have used, you know, exact images, layout, text from our site, I think that definitely crosses an ethical boundary. But, you know, I think if it's you know, someone looking at what we do, and right now we only ship to the U.S. and Canada, and so if they think that there is a, you know, an interesting opportunity in Europe to provide affordable glasses, then, you know, I have no problem with them going after that opportunity if they're bringing something new and innovative to that market. I think if it's an exact replica and naming it something like Schwarby marker or something, then I do think that crosses a line.
What if they gave it a different name, but they were selling glasses online, free returns, amazing customer service, just in Europe? You guys in Europe. No copying of the format.
So that exists today, and it's not something I'm happy about, but I don't think it crosses kind of an ethical boundary unless they're kind of directly lifting things from our website, or I think there's no intellectual property around a business model, and so if they want to launch it, that's fine. Eventually, we will launch in Europe, and we'll. Our expectation is that we'll do a much better job than they will, and we're going to have all these learnings from the U.S. market, and we're just going to be much more passionate about this and have all the kind of all the thoughts that went into coming up with this idea in the first place. They don't have kind of that thought process and kind of all the things that we put in place to make sure that we have the best possible offering for our customers. All those intangibles are difficult to replicate, and all the things behind the scenes, as Katya was saying. So if they want to launch this, that's fine. We think that when we do launch in Europe, we'll crush them.
Okay. So you're a pragmatist. You bring on the competition. We're going to get there eventually, and we're going to do better.
Yeah, and I think it's the same thing for people in other categories. So there are a bunch of other sites that have launched the Warby Parker of underwear and just kind of in a bunch of other categories. And I think that's totally fine. At some point down the road, we might go into other verticals, but I don't think we can kind of claim every direct to consumer fashion product is. Is protected because we launched with glasses.
Okay. Yeah. So this is the world we live in. Okay. So taking a pragmatist approach, and realize that there are people gunning for you. It's actually a fantastic form of flattery that people want to copy your business in other countries, in other verticals. So what do we do about this? The topic is how to ensure that your startup is defensible. What can you do to defend? What are some specific things that you would recommend to entrepreneurs out there who are starting fresh?
Well, I think that the number one thing you can do is just execute. So first you should execute to get to the point where somebody cares enough about what you're doing to replicate it. So don't be looking over your shoulder, right? So you got to execute first. And then once the competition starts, you stay in front of them by continuing to execute and staying heads down. Now, we don't look much at the competition. I keep an eye on them just out of curiosity, but we don't talk about it as a team. We don't spend a lot of time on it. Even though Priceline's doing TV ads on prime time with Tonight Only deals and their product. So, we don't spend a lot of time on that. We think more about how we can delight our customers, how we can provide great support, how we can provide great deals. We have a product that's better. We know it's better, and we want to make it even better than that. So,
Kind of classically focusing on the fact that if it was your idea that that there's something inherently particular with how you came up with it and the reasoning that you came up with it and kind of how you identified what the pain points were in the market that made sense for your idea. And I do think that focusing on the product and delivering an excellent product to whomever your customer is, whether you're a B2C business or a B2B business or a combination of both, is definitely the most important thing. I guess I'd also say that, it's ridiculous to say that you don't notice the competition. Of course you notice the competition. I think what you can't do is let that make you think that your idea is, there's anything to change about what you're doing. We're all learning from each other. Just as the competition learned from you, you should be looking and seeing if they're doing something interesting. And I really believe in that. That's what we're saying is okay. It's not unethical to see how people have interpreted your idea and try to understand whether, what was their insight in the pain point. And I do think it's important to ask that question because if they've taken it, they've derived something, and it's a little bit different, it's a tweak, you should understand why.
Wait, okay, so Katya, you are kind of looking over your shoulder but looking for some improvements.
You have to focus. You have to look ahead, but I think it's just ridiculous to say you don't notice. No, we, of course, notice.
So Sam is the one who just said he doesn't notice.
I'm not ridiculous, am I? So I didn't say we don't notice. I say that we don't. The point is not. It's easy to get fixated on it, and it's easy to think that the sky's going to fall. You know, when we first heard that Priceline was launching, it was a really, you know, there were people in the office that were really scared about it. And so we just said, hey, you know, it's going to happen. That's the reality. But it's not going to change what we do. On a day-to-day basis, we need to continue to provide great deals. We need to continue to expand, need to make the product better. We'll look at what they do and see if there's anything that, you know, we can learn from that, sure. But that is, you know, 1% of the time that we could spend on analyzing them and thinking about contingency and what are they going to do next. And if you spend too much time on that, you drain all your resources, and it's usually all for naught. We went down a couple of conversations about what would they do, and they didn't do any of it. So it's been pretty interesting.
And I also think focus on what they can't do, especially if you're dealing with like an incumbent. I think that is, you know, a really simple conversation to have is what is different about what you're creating than, you know, what has ever been out there, why you started this. And you can really get excited and forward-looking when you focus on what you as a company are equipped to do.
So what are things that you could do that your incumbent couldn't do?
For trucks? Or?
Well, you can either answer for your company or you can answer generally. I mean, why can't your competition do all the things?
I mean, it depends on who they are. So in the case of having an incumbent, I think a company that has like a side business in what you're doing cannot focus. That's just the bottom line. Their focus is on their primary revenue model, and your focus is on your primary revenue model. So you get to pour all of your energy into that which you created versus, you know, a side business.
Sure. It's because the world's moving, right? So execution is critical. You have to stay ahead. I think even the most innovative companies in the world are taking inspiration from the world around them and applying best practices. But they're doing so like in a greenfield space, which creates opportunity, which creates the followers. It's the despicable copycats that like set up in your backyard and are like view the world as zero sum and are essentially creating the zero sum game by copying you. And it happens, and I think the best way to outpace that is just to keep building, build faster, be agile, which is the best defense against the larger incumbents because they're inherently less agile.
So what are you guys doing to, I mean, you have a number of direct clones and you have other sort of grassroots type similar companies. Mm-hmm. What are you doing to stay ahead of them?
So on two sides. So one, the big incumbents tend to work with like IBM and ATG and these big e-commerce platforms. And so they're beholden to these third-party organizations to own their online shopping experiences, whereas we're building our own technology organization, our own e-commerce. We own our whole stack. And then on the designer side, the bigger players tend to rip off smaller designers just blatantly. And whereas we've taken a partnership approach with the designers that we work with to actually help them build more sustainable businesses. And so we have that preferred relationship with the indie designers where we actually get the most innovative product coming out of that community. So there's innovation on both sides. And just like a view of the world, like we're oriented on a specific community of customers. And like our goal is to create an amazing experience for her and bring a never-ending stream of products to market that she's going to love and do so in collaboration with her where she gets to participate. And that's just like total paradigm difference from the fashion industry, which is typically like, we're going to tell you what's cool, and you're going to wear it. It's going to be out of trend next season. Don't wear this season stuff next season. And you know, kind of regardless of whether it's going to look good on your body type or not. And so the stance we're taking, the position we're taking as a company is just fundamentally opposed to the majority of the fashion industry.
So that's a great example of what Katya was just talking about, something that you as a new innovator can do that the large incumbent would never be able to do. Just turn around their entire ship, so to speak.
I put it as extraordinarily unlikely to do.
Okay. So that's a great advantage, actually, at least from one category of clones. Warby, how about, Warby Parker, what are you guys doing to ward off the competition?
I mean, so we're really trying to create a fashion brand and launch a fashion brand, and PR is kind of a huge component of that, and getting a stamp of approval from key influencers and publications in the fashion world is incredibly important, and so we launched with features in GQ and Vogue and have continued to invest really heavily in getting great press and build relationships with key editors, stylists, and fashion influencers. And I think that's been a huge reason why we've gained so much traction. Until a few weeks ago, we hadn't done any paid customer acquisition. So our awareness had just been generated through PR and word of mouth. And I think people, they want to be associated. They want to talk about, they want to write about innovators. It's just not as interesting to write about copycats. And no. So that's been a huge reason why the copycat sites that have launched haven't gained any traction. And I don't think that entered into their calculus when they were copying our site. They said, oh, well, we can source these glasses, we can sell them online. But they didn't think about the fact that the only reason why we had grown so quickly was because we were doing something innovative, and it's something that people wanted to talk about. I think that is actually a very big barrier. And there's in today's world where there is so much noise through Twitter, Tumblr, and kind of there's so much content being generated, so many new companies coming out, people just have a limited bandwidth. And so if you can establish that awareness and build these relationships with key people in the media, that becomes a really big barrier to overcome.
So that's really interesting. So you can win the PR war just by being innovative. People are going to want to write about the innovative stories. You get a huge leg up on that front. Do the customers also respect that? Would you say that your customers are more loyal to you since you are first, or do they just go where the coolest glasses are and the cheapest price?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'd like to think that our customers are much more loyal than folks buying from these other sites. One thing that we track really closely is our Net Promoter Score, which is a measure of customer satisfaction. And our scores are consistently in the high 80s or low 90s, which is higher than Zappos and Apple. And so I think people do want to be, customers also want to be associated with innovators, and they want to tell other people. Like, everyone wants to have a story around kind of the dinner table, and it just becomes that much more interesting if it's an authentic story. And I think the nice thing about building direct-to-consumer businesses online is that you can create that really authentic relationship with customers, where you can create content and have these really deep interactions where people feel like they're kind of part of the brand and they want to introduce that to other people. I think there certainly is an element of having that that innovative company to talk about that is a big driver of word of mouth as well.
Yeah. So you've talked about this. Katya, I can see nodding your head. You feel similarly. Mm-hmm. Similar things going on in Birchbox with deeply loyal customers. ModCloth, no mm-hmm. question. So, these are, all companies where you are, have something that you're wearing on your body, consumer facing. It's easy to get passionate and loyal about these things. Hotels, what can consumers get excited and passionate about a hotel brand?
We've seen that they can, but leading question. But yes.
I guess you're going to say yes. Sorry. Yes.
We've got
it. It's sort of in general. Does this advice work for all companies once you get outside of sort of the sexy fashion space?
Well, I think it works for all companies. I think that the thing that's different about a hotel tonight is that we don't make the products that we don't send a physical product, right? There's at the end of the day, we do a transaction. We hand it off to somebody else for fulfillment. So we've got supplier networks and supplier relationships to think of within our competitive set, and how do we get inventory? How do we maintain great relationships with hotels? So the consideration for us early on was, how do we make these suppliers very happy with working with us, and how do we make them addicted to working with us? And the best way to do that, we can be nice, we can merchandise their hotels well, we can be a cool brand, we can spend money on advertising. All of that's for naught unless we're selling rooms and putting heads in beds. And so we focused very much on doing that. The nice part about that is that that actually was about growing the business, was making sure that we were selling rooms. So we focused all of our real efforts on sort of competitive barriers to entry, really on just growing the business. And by doing that, we created this addictive action response type of relationship with hotels, where they loaded the hotel inventory that morning, we sold it within a couple hours. And so they then said, hey, this works, we're going to use it again. And that had them coming back to us. And so I'd say that, if anybody doing a business that revolves around exclusive or direct relationships with suppliers needs to think about how quickly you can get the flywheel of transactions going, so that those those suppliers become dependent on you for a significant portion of their business, or in our case, it's maybe not a significant portion overall, but it's a very strategically important portion, which is the last few rooms they have to sell.
Yeah, we haven't really touched on like defensibility by having relationships with suppliers, and I think that is a really important point. If you're not vertically integrated and you're going to have partners on the supply side, thinking through what winning is to them, whether it's like selling out the room or what their goals are, and structuring the product very thoughtfully around that is a huge part of building defensibility, because to the extent that those relationships are ongoing, that's obviously going to affect what the consumer is experiencing and their delight factor with your product. So I think that seems pretty obvious and clear, but thinking through that and asking those questions and allowing them to be a part of building on that side was incredibly important with our business, and I think that it's just kind of an important thing to be considering, is not just kind of who are your customers, and in the case of Hotel Tonight, in the case of our business, we have customers on both sides of the platform.
So that's a very, very insightful point. I mean, so here we're thinking about, on one side, we have passionate customers and authenticity that wins the PR race that is very difficult to imitate. But the side that we don't think about necessarily, where is this inventory coming from? What are the relationships that we're building? That, once you build those, that is incredibly difficult to replicate. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it also sounds like this is kind of a zero-sum game. So once you start establishing relationships with some of your key suppliers, that leaves less for the others. Is that true?
Definitely. I would definitely say so. We hear all the time from our partners that they get approached and, you know, their response is like, we're working with Birchbox, and that's that.
Hmm. There's clearly a network effect with supplier relationships, in that a hotel doesn't want to load last-minute inventory on 25 different sites.
Right.
They want to load it on one site and have that move the inventory. Maybe they'll load it on a few, but they'd prefer to load it on just one that takes care of it for them.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about something that's like sits squarely in between and kind of impacts both, which is the passion of your team, like the degree to which that you're authentic and purpose-driven versus like purely opportunistic and profit-driven translates into a totally different level of engagement from your team. And that translates into like it comes across when you're engaging with your suppliers, and it especially comes across when you're engaging with your customers. And that really inspires the passion on both sides. And that, I love thinking about, especially like in the context of a hotel environment where you get these gigantic incumbents where the employees just don't care. And that is a competitive advantage for sure, that you have a team that really cares.
Yeah. So deep relationships with suppliers, customers, and your own employees, yeah. Suddenly we're actually starting to find some barriers that you would not think about superficially. Well, let me ask this then. So, you know, all of this stuff has to require a lot of investment and a lot of time, and it has to slow you down compared to, let's take the Samver brothers, who just have a scattershot and say, we're going to start in 40 companies now, throw caution to the wind, don't worry about margins now, we're going to worry about that later. So that has to slow you down relative to some of these competitors who say, we're going to at least get big fast, and we're going to worry about relationships and margins and that kind of stuff later. Is that a concern that you have to go more slowly than you would like, or is that just something you're comfortable with, or is it not even true?
I think you're talking about like the capital's perspective. So like if you're a venture capitalist, it's really nice to say.
Apologies. Like, yeah, you teach at Harvard Business School.
It's cool. Like I'm. Okay. I'd like to invest in a direct analogy in a different market where there is no direct competition. Like that's an easy investment thesis. I think that from the innovator's perspective, capital can be a huge advantage. So if you are leading, the degree to which you can raise more capital than your competition can help create distance. But yeah, I think the way you phrased the question is, I mean, from their perspective, sure, they're taking these like sort of proven things and they're still, you know, carbon copying them over and over again. It's a lower risk investment than investing in a leap of faith.
If there are any empirical researches out here, this sort of leads to a really interesting question, is sort of following the path of, you know, here's an innovator, here are all the second movers, and it can get really scary to wake up and see, oh my God, there are 20 companies doing the exact same thing as me. How many of those actually survive? So, you know, we have a lot of faith on the panel that, you know, they're doing things in a much more deep and sustainable way, and that a lot of these guys are just going to die out in the end. So, you know, from an empirical perspective, you know, is that actually true? So, you know, I'd leave that question to the scientists in the audience. Really, I mean, clearly with Groupon, we've seen that to be the case. I mean, we know these clones are just dying all over the place. But, you know, to what degree that could actually be measured would be very, very interesting. And actually, I think, should provide a lot more confidence to innovators when you are worried. Just recognize that, you know, some of these threats may actually be a little bit more empty. So, you know, any last words on, you know, recommendations that you would give to people who are thinking about starting up, you know, what they should do from day one to defend their company? After that, we'll do 10 minutes of Q&A. Last words?
I'll do.
Go ahead.
Let's say do something meaningful that you're really passionate about, because that is what inspires everything. So yeah, I would say be very meaning and purpose driven.
And, you know, being in an industry where being small, if you're going up against incumbents, but being small and creative and clever is a virtue, like it is with us, and where, you know, when I did the analysis of whether or not we should even launch this business, I knew that we'd get competition, but I knew that we would have a number of advantages in our size and in our focus.
I think be very honest with yourself about what your competitive advantage is, and revisit that idea continuously so that you can still, you know, that should evolve. That is something that is logical to evolve. But also when you are first starting and you'll always have to make the choice about where to allocate your resources, you need to really focus on investing in your competitive advantage. I know that seems really clear, but when you're day-to-day executing the business and other things come up and your resources are constantly being drained on, as long as you understand that you're investing in the competitive advantage, you're making the right decision with your, you know, resources, which is capital, time, and everything.
Yeah, and I would just say that, you know, just have an awareness that the copycats are going to emerge if you are successful. But you really shouldn't spend any time thinking about them. Kind of every second that you spend thinking about your competitors as opposed to your customers is a waste of time. And so just, you know, kind of continue to innovate and just provide better service, quality, and value for your customers, and you'll end up beating kind of any copycats that emerge.
You know, these four did not actually coordinate on their positions beforehand. So if there is any better evidence than seeing four successful founders of companies describe how the importance of being passionate to multiple different groups, your customers, your suppliers, your own employees, I don't know what better evidence there is. Creating a long-term, sustainable, successful business, very, very difficult to replicate. People are going to replicate. Be prepared for that, recognize that, and continue doing what you do best. That's really, really actually not only useful to hear, but also very inspiring. All right, so let's thank our panelists for being with us here today. If anybody has any questions, please come up to the mic in the center. We'll just form a little line and go for it.
This question's mainly directed at Katia and Sam. I'm just interested, in the face of competition and in the early days of developing the product, how can you convince your suppliers to sort of maintain exclusivity with you, perhaps when they're seeing other companies and you don't have any proven success to go off at that stage?
That's a really good question. I think your first instinct is to ask for exclusivity, and I think that is like the kind of trigger reaction. That was definitely my first thought, and then quickly followed by asking for exclusivity only draws attention to the fact that it's not just you. And I think it gets back to the point of focusing and looking forward and focusing on delivering the best product. We never ask for exclusivity, and we're constantly told by our partners that they would never work with anybody like us, and it's not even a conversation we try to have. So if you focus on delivering a wonderful product, we do focus on making sure that they understand our value proposition to them, which is being the best ROI place for a sample. You're going to get the best ROI. And we do sell that, but we don't talk about the alternatives. We just talk about what we do. And I think that was our decision, was to not have it in there.
And we don't sign any exclusivity contracts with our providers. And in fact, we bend over backwards to be very flexible with them. And then we can we provide on our back end a button that says, close me out, I'm full. I sold my rooms out with other channels. And that's instant. It takes effect immediately. Other online travel agencies, when they push that button, it really means they make a phone call. And that phone call then takes an hour to route through. And meanwhile, they're still getting reservations for rooms they no longer have. So we work very hard to make it extremely flexible for them. And then I'd say, just to reiterate, the best defense on this is a really strong offense. So we just really focus on putting heads in beds.
Hi. My question is, you were talking about how good product, good team is very important in how you diversify from the copycats. What if you're in a situation where the copycat is already there and you're also a copycat, but, well, let's specify, I'm actually a copycat in the Netherlands from Birchbox,
yeah.
But we have the Somewhere Brothers who came in a little bit before us, and they're very much on well, the product, the CEO, the affiliating and stuff like that, and we're trying to focus on the product, but will that also work when you're the second one?
So we have seen copies of Birchbox that honestly, like, we look at, and my partner and I are like, wow, this is really great. They really have understood what the needs of their market were. They really are thinking about delivering something great to the customer. It seems like they're getting brands. So I honestly do feel like we can see when a copycat has a vision and has a vision that is maybe more aligned with ours. So I don't really know about advice for a copy of a copy, but I do really still think if you, what Somewhere Brothers are doing is more of something where, like, they want to be huge, they want to have a great business model, the business model seems exciting to them, but I think if you think about the long-term sustainability of the business model and you focus on building a really strong brand and incredible relationships, I do think that that's a competitive advantage. I mean, I don't have the answer for you, but they have a lot. They have a lot of things that they're looking at the same time, and you don't. And you have the sense of what the market is around you. So own what you're great at. I mean, own the fact that you think that you understand this market.
We didn't really talk about it, but brand as a competitive advantage is really something we think about a lot and focus on. And I call it the soul of the brand. Does the brand have soul? Does it have an emotional connection with customers? And if the Somewhere Brothers, I don't think any of their businesses have really ever had any soul. I don't think they're very good at that. They're good at copying. So focus on that emotional connection, which is hard to define. It's hard to build. It comes through just really strong dedication to your customer needs and surprising and delighting them with unexpected things that are going to create that connection.
Hi. I've been in the software business for a very long time, and in the software business, great ideas come. You know, Google was not the first search engine, right? We all know that Amazon wasn't the first people to sell stuff online. We all know that other people come along and they maybe improve what you do. So my question is, we heard a lot about brands and passion and being first and all of that. If you thought about it in a more of a software sense, when it comes to CMS, you know, a content management system, WordPress and things like that, went open source. They kind of reversed and they said, you know what, have all the way we think. Would you consider white labeling what you do? Would you consider, you know, basically breaking out of the fact that you've got a domain name with a thing and say, look, we're the thing that's behind it. You can call it what you want and actually sell that business model as your business model. And what are your thoughts about kind of a more innovative way to capitalize on your own ideas?
I think that there are some businesses that work really well for. I think you just have to be honest about what is going to work for your business. So if you think that having a soul and connecting with a customer on a deeper level requires that you invest in a brand, then it's harder to justify white labeling, right? Because we would argue that getting a box of samples every month that had no soul is something that you quit pretty quickly because it's just not compelling. So I think that that's the question. And it's definitely a great question because it's something you have to think about right away. If it's something that just works, if you could just scale it, you know, everybody that came to us to partner was just asking for us if we would white label. And if we thought that that was compelling to the customer, then Of course. I think our position is that it's not, that the voice is special, and that who is behind it is something that actually people really care about, which is why, you know, the most popular content we create is what's on our editor's desks or our employees got a haircut, and people really do connect with what's behind. So it just, I think it depends on what you're selling.
Yeah, I mean, we use Ruby on Rails and on SQL, and so like we're really taking advantage of the open source community, and like that they made a lot possible for us, and we encourage our engineers to contribute back. Although I'd say we're more recipients than we are contributors at this stage. The question is like what is it that you're all about versus like what is something that you should share with the world because it's additive and it's going to contribute to, you know, the greater knowledge or the greater like open source community. And I think in software, it's a good example because there's so many components of it that have really no contribution to your businesses or your brand's competitive advantage. It's like, why not share that with, you know, greater community that's also contributing to your business in other ways?
And I've got strong opinions about white labeling versus branded sites. So if you look at the history of successful businesses within a very specific, within any category, and I have not found an example of where white label businesses or the white labeling model, private label model, exceeded the value of the dominant brand within that category. I think Inktomi versus Google is a great example of this. And there's other examples in most categories. And I think that, so I would say that if you're the way to enter that market is to be the white label, I'd say go invent another market.
There's okay. There's Amazon AWS, which is like an interesting example where it's not exactly giving it away, right? They're monetizing some aspect of their business in this other way. Yeah.
Okay, we're out of time. Your question maybe can come up later. These guys will stick around to answer a couple of questions afterwards. But thanks everybody for having a great discussion.
Thank you.